طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And this is your host, John Roberts. This week we feature James Zugby, founder and president of the American Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based organization which serves as a political and policy research arm of the Arab American community. James Zugby was born in the United States of Palestinian parents and is an important Palestinian voice that needs to be heard. Unfortunately, just when Palestinian voices need to be elevated, they are heard less and less frequently in our media. And he speaks to that issue in this presentation. On May 22, 2018, he spoke to the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center. And it begins with his introduction by Director Mohammed Mohammed.
Hello, everybody. Thanks again for joining us here at the Jerusalem Fund. And as I always mention, if you could please silence your cell phones so we can avoid that awkward interruption. My name is Mohammed Mohammed. I'm the executive director here at the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center. And on behalf of our board of directors and staff, it's always a pleasure to have you here. And it's always a pleasure to have everybody online. So thank you all for joining us. It's also a great honor to introduce and welcome back our distinguished speaker today, Dr. James Zugby, who will be speaking about political Zionism and the roots of Palestinian dispossession. As most of you know, this year marks the 70th anniversary of the Nakba, which resulted in hundreds of thousands of Palestinians being forced to become stateless refugees, including my own grandparents. And they became refugees in exile, waiting to return to their homes, while many others were reduced to aliens in their own country, living under Israeli military rule. Although the Nakba produced a nightmare for the Palestinian people, it has largely been ignored in the West. Palestinians have been victims, but in the U.S. they have been invisible victims. When Palestinians are considered at all, they are referred to as the Palestinian problem, confronting Israel, and the problem that must somehow be resolved so that Israelis can have peace. In this talk, Dr. Zugby will review the ideology and practice of the movement of political Zionism and its patron, British imperialism, that together were responsible for the denial of Palestinian rights and the subsequent campaigns of disinformation and the repression against the Palestinian people. His updated book, I believe he wrote this book many, many years ago, but he has an updated version. It's called Palestinians, Invisible Victims. They'll also be made available after the event for free of charge, so please grab a copy on your way out. A little bit about, for those of you who do not know, Dr. James Zugby co-founded the Arab American Institute in 1985 and continues to serve as its president. He's director of Zugby Research Services, which is a firm that has conducted groundbreaking surveys across the Middle East. For the past three decades, he has served in leadership roles in the Democratic National Committee and served two terms as a President Obama appointee to the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. He writes a weekly column published in 12 countries. He is featured frequently on national and international media as an expert on Middle East affairs. In 2010, Zugby published the highly acclaimed book, Arab Voices. His 2003 e-books, Looking at Iran, The Rise and Fall of Iran and Arab Public Opinion, and 20 years after Oslo are drawn from his extensive polling across the Middle East with Zoghbi Research Services. Dr. Zoghbi will speak for 30 to 45 minutes, after which we will have a Q&A session. Again, as always, we ask that you wait for the mic to come to you, please, before you ask a question, especially so that everybody can hear online as well. And for the online audience, you can tweet your questions to @PalestineCenter. Please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Dr. James Zoghbi.
Thank you. I wanted to begin with a little bit on the history of this book. I first wrote it in 1976. I was speaking at NYU on the problem of the issue of Zionism and human rights. And I took the paper that I gave to that gathering, and I published it in a book. The AAUG at the time, the Association of Arab American University Graduates, published it under the title Zionism and the Problem of Palestinian Human Rights. In 1980, I was invited to the first of the UN Special Unit on Palestine international seminars on the question of Palestine, to the Vienna conference, and I enlarged the paper and presented it there. And then in 1981, the ADC, I was the co-founder and director there, we published it in a book called It Palestinians, the Invisible Victims. There were about three copies left in print. I owned them all. And I just sat there on my shelf for years. And about a half year ago, I just took it out and read it. And I said, damn, this is pretty good. This says some stuff that people ought to know. And I guess what bothered me about it was the following. When it first came out, I made the ADL and AJC hit list. You know, it was I was an anti-Semite because I said these things about Zionism and I said these things about Israel. And how dare I accuse the Jewish state of deliberately expelling Palestinians, or et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you weather those storms. Somebody asked me recently, did that alter my career? And it didn't. It actually just reinforced my career. That's what I was going to be. I never wanted to be a podiatrist, and that was never, you know, just that wasn't who I was. I was going to be an activist on this issue. And that was the price you pay for doing it. Then I started over the last couple of years, actually. I mean, Benny Morris came out with his book. But over the last couple of years, if you follow the press in Israel or the Forward or some of the stuff that Jewish Voice for Peace or other groups like that are talking about, a lot of this is there. You know, I mean, I remember reading right before the Trump visit an article on Haaretz about the Mughrabi quarter, where the Wailing Wall was. It was a very poignant story about how on one night in the 67 war, they just sent in guys with bulldozers and sledgehammers and destroyed an entire neighborhood, reduced it to rubble in order to create the plaza. And I thought, God, you know, they're going there to pray at this plaza over the ruins of the homes of 1,000 people. That was in Haaretz. There will be other stories that you will see in Haaretz about some of the things that Moshe Sharet had said in his fight with David Ben-Gurion over how the Jewish state should deal with the Arab population. And I got mad a little bit. I said those things 40 years ago, and he got beaten up for it. But now it's there. But an entire generation of people don't know it. So we decided to take the book and reissue it. You have an earlier version of the reissuing. It's now coming out again with Mondo Weiss, the website that I just love for its content. They are co-producing it with us with an introduction by Philip Weiss. And in a conversation I had with them, they asked me, you know, you said all this stuff 40 years ago. Do you feel like you were clairvoyant? I said, no, at all. Because, I mean, where did I get a lot of this from? I got it from Edward Said. I got it from Waleed Khalidi. I got it from Brahim Al-Abed at the Palestine Research Center. This stuff, we knew this stuff. You just couldn't say it. In you could say it among ourselves. We said it at AAUG conferences, but you couldn't say it in an American audience or you got blasted for it. But the time is now where you can say it and you need to say it. And so we came out with the book. Actually, in the first week on Amazon, it was the number one new read. So I felt pretty good about that. So our tweets have borne some fruit. What is the book about? What does it do? What it does is it attempts to explain why Palestinians are invisible victims. In the introduction, part of my introduction was read to you. The issue that confounded me then, I was, remember, in 1976 when I was speaking at NYU first time on this, giving this paper, I was had founded the Palestine Human Rights Campaign. Why did we do it? What was it about? It was about trying to put a face on Palestinian victims. They were not known. And look, just think about it. We had a situation in Gaza, a massacre, 63 people, not a single face, not a single name, not a single human story. If one Israeli soldier had been killed, we'd know the name, we'd see the face, we'd hear the family. The evening news, I remember in a situation in 1981 where you might remember the bombing of the Fakhani neighborhood in Beirut. There had been a clash across the border in Lebanon between the PLO and Israelis. And that first night, one Israeli had died and two were wounded. CBS News turned it on that night and you had ambulances and, you know, flashing lights and the cameraman there, you know, catching all of this drama, and they interviewed the people in this Israeli settlement about the trauma of these people killed in this clash. In retaliation, they called it, the Israelis bombed the Fakhani neighborhood in Beirut, which is where the PLO offices were. And I think it was 283 people were killed in an apartment building that was devastated. And I turned on CBS News the next night, and the announcer was there in Israel saying, we bombed, Israeli bombed the whatever. The third day, the story came from Lebanon, and it was the guy stationed in Lebanon standing in front of an empty street that of bombed out buildings, saying, behind me are the buildings that Israel bombed and killed this many people. When I challenged them about it, the guy, the newsman from Beirut, came back with the explanation that they had gotten there that night. But he said it was too dusty and it was too crowded and too congested, and you couldn't get a picture of what was going on, so we decided to wait the next day so we should show the devastation. The point, in other words, was that for CBS News back then, the Israeli who died was worth the story of the ambulances and the turmoil and the people to be interviewed about how shocked and traumatic the event was. But in Lebanon, the story was the empty buildings that got destroyed. The people didn't matter. When Baruch Goldstein massacred people in the mosque in Hebron, the Washington Post had two front page stories on why did the good doctor go bad. One was on the front page, number one. The other was the front page of the style section. Not a single story about the Palestinian victims. Their names were never known. Their stories were never told. Their families were never interviewed. They didn't count. Not a new problem. It's an old problem. The question was, why did it happen? How did it occur? How did this people end up not being human at all so that they became, as I like to say it, the Israeli people versus the Palestine problem. And you got to solve the problem so the people can have peace. That's all that mattered. Even look at the Trump plan today, what you see of the shell of it, the outline of it. It's like they're chess pieces on a board to be moved around so Israel will be secure. It's not Israeli people versus Palestinian people. It's Israeli people versus the problem. How do we solve the problem? That, I argue, in the book goes back to the very foundation of this dilemma. From the very beginning of this, when the British and French plans became known, Woodrow Wilson intervened and he made his famous proclamation. There were a lot of problems with Woodrow Wilson, but he did make his proclamation about self-determination. And he said to the British and French, I don't agree. You cannot just do this. You can't carve this all up among yourselves. He said, it really should depend on what the people want. And so being a pollster in the Middle East myself, I appreciate the fact that he commissioned the first poll of Arab public opinion, and it was the King Crane Commission. He sent over one American professor and one American businessman who interviewed a couple thousand different groups and people to come up with a comprehensive view of what the Arabs wanted in the post-war period, what they would accept. Well, we know the results, that they overwhelmingly rejected the mandate. They didn't want anything to do with the British and French. Back then, they did want the Americans involved. They wouldn't today. And they overwhelmingly rejected the notion that there should be a separate Jewish state on their territory. What I found interesting was that when told of this enterprise, polling the opinion, the declaration author, Lord Balfour, said, in Palestine, he said, we do not propose to even go through the form of consulting its inhabitants as to their wishes. Zionism is of far greater importance than the desire and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who inhabit that ancient land. Another British Brit at the time said, it's a false view of democratic principles that holds because a race or nation happens to occupy a certain territory, that territory is its for all time. Nor has any race the absolute right to determine its own future at the expense of some other race which may have more to give to the world. This was the foundation of this experience, this enterprise. Max Nordau, one of Herzl's colleagues, said, described the Jewish people as a people more industrious and more able than even the average European, not to speak of the inert African. The British saw Palestine as an important colonial outpost. And the way that they did it, the British and French had different ways of colonizing. What the British did was they sent companies to govern in their stead. So you had the India Company, you had African companies. The company that was going to do it for the Brits, they thought, was the Zionist movement. It was a perfect fit. It was like a marriage made in heaven. We need somebody to govern for us because it was the northern end of the Suez Canal. It was the eastern end of the Mediterranean. They needed somebody to operate in their stead. It was what Lebanon was going to be. The French way of doing it was to pit one group of people against another and cultivate one as the, so they cultivated the Maronites as their group that would provide the entrepôt. Beirut was going to be the entry to their part of the Arab East. Palestine was to be the British entry point, and it was to be the Jewish people. This was Lord Shaftesbury. Syria and Palestine will be, before long, become very important. The company needs capital and population. The Jews can give it both. And has not England a special interest in promoting such restoration? It would be a blow to England if either of her two rivals should get hold of Syria. Does not policy there exhort England to foster the nationality of the Jews and aid them to return to England and then naturally belongs the role of favoring the settlement of the Jews in Palestine. It was a strategic partnership. It was a strategic partnership that saw the native no differently than they saw the natives in any other place they colonized, as trees to be removed from the frontier to make way for progress, to make way for a people who could give more to them and more to the world than the indigenous people of the land. And so from the beginning, Palestinians were a problem or an obstacle to be removed, an invisible set of victims. Zionism, which grew up in Western Europe as an ideology. Now, understand that it didn't have to end up this way. There were multiple threads of Zionism. There was a religious Zionism movement. There was a cultural Zionism. There was a Martin Buber who taught and thought that a partnership and a relationship can be developed between peoples that would build a prosperous land for both. He would have been a one-stater these days. But the political Zionist movement, which saw the displacement of the indigenous people and their replacement by them under the patronage of a colonial power, them operating as a colonial power, was what ultimately won the day. And as I just hinted at before, there were disputes even within the political Zionist movement. I mean, Moshe Sharet, the first, one of the early leaders of the state and a prime minister at one point, actually disputed Ben Gurion's whole approach. When the point was made that over partition, the concern that the Jewish side had was that the UN partition was going to provide a bulk of land for the Jewish people and a bulk of land for the Arab people. The Jewish part was to include over 80% of all the Jews in Palestine, but it was still only 55% Jewish. 45% of it was Arab. And 34% of it was owned by Arabs, and only 9% was owned by Jews. And so it was not exactly their state. It was going to be, had more land ownership on the Arab side, and had 45% of the population was Arab. On the other hand, the Arab state was overwhelmingly Arab and included land only owned by Arabs in that part of the area. The plan was, what do you do with this? And that was when the plan was developed to literally make the state more Jewish and larger. Ben-Gurion called it, at the end, a double miracle. We got more land and less Arabs. It was, again, they were like trees on the frontier to be cleared. It wasn't real people. What made the Nakba possible was that it was not just something that was desirable, but it was to be inevitable to fulfill the plan. Moshe Sharet didn't support it. And so you'll find in the writings here a dispute over, this isn't who we are, this isn't how we should behave. He went along with it, but he still, in his diaries, wrote about his disapproval of it. Unfortunately, today, those voices have largely been silenced in Israel. And you have in the governing coalition people whose philosophy of how to deal with Arabs, it pretty much echoes some of these quotes from the turn of the last century, some of the same attitudes of Palestinians being less than human, less desirable, and needing to be removed and dealt with, from Avigdor Lieberman to Bennett and others. The dehumanization of Palestinians is quite disturbing. What is changing, though, is that here in the States, you have, in reaction to that, a kind of a split, not only in the public opinion as a whole, but in the Jewish community in particular, and some remarkable groups echoing again some of the earlier alternatives to Zionism. You know, the group Breira that existed way back when? It was founded as a group that was an alternative to Zionism. Zionism had said, political Zionism said, there is no alternative but to do this. And Breira said there is an alternative. So they call themselves Breira, which means alternative. There's another way of being Jewish that doesn't mean another people paying the price. Breira was destroyed by the Jewish establishment, but other groups have now come today that are too strong to be destroyed. Groups like Jewish Voice for Peace or If Not Now, are making real headway in terms of changing opinion among young Jews. I would say what's helping that is the marriage between Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump, which is really quite stunning. It's difficult if you're Jewish and you hate Donald Trump to find Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu actually agreeing on almost everything. And that creates an opening in consciousness that is changing the way people are seeing the conflict. And it's happening in the broader public as well. What I wanted to do when we came out with the book was to say, that's good that this change is occurring, but I don't want the change to occur just because people are angry with Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. I want them to understand that there's a history here that needs to be understood from the beginning, that an injustice was done to an entire people who need to have their faces written back into history. They need to not be invisible anymore. Doing what needs to be done is not something just because it's anti-Israel. It needs to be pro-Palestinian as well. This equation of how to deal with the conflict can't just be Israeli people and the Palestine problem, so you solve the problem so the Israelis can be secure. It's got to be Israeli people and Palestinian people finding a future where both lives matter. And so I'm hoping that the book will maybe stir some debate, maybe inform some people, and maybe create a sense of awareness about what Palestinians have endured. It tells the story not just of the pre-state period. It tells the story of what happened to the Palestinians who stayed behind from 48 to 67. It tells the story of what happened during the early years of the occupation. The book actually was written in 1981, but you already had a pretty horrible record of human rights violations at that point, and they've continued on and changed in scope. This is not the early years of the occupation we're living through anymore. It's a very different situation. But nevertheless, it's a story that needs to be told. And so I thank you for coming. I thank you for getting the book. You can, if you're watching online, you can buy it on Amazon. It's called Palestinians, the Invisible Victims, and I hope you will. Thank you. And I'll take any questions.
Jim, it's great to see you again. And you have done a wonderful work for the community. But I'm still disappointed that our voice...
Next question? No, sir.
Yes. It's coming up. It's coming up. It's all praiseworthy. I am wondering why we are not making our voice heard in the media. Mm. Why can't we have more Arab Americans write columns, letters, whatever, even buy space in the newspapers? Yeah. What is the problem? We have to do this immediately.
George, I can't speak to why more people don't write. I can speak to the media, though, and that is one of the huge disappointments I think we all of us have to deal with. There was a time when we literally were shut out of the discussion. That began to change in the 80s, and I think that the war in the Gulf in 90, 91 was maybe the high point where our voices were sought on a fairly regular basis, almost consuming basis, and there were multiple voices that were there. And that lasted throughout the whole Oslo period that followed. After 9/11, again, we were widely sought, and you had multiple personalities from the community who were on television fairly regularly. Largely, the questions that we were asked were had to do with, I sort of irreverently refer to it as, tell us how the little brown people are doing, you know. Is it really hard being Arab these days? You know, it was that kind of thing. When it came time to talk about policy issues, like what was actually happening in the region, they went to the experts. And in Washington and in New York, the experts are usually failed political leaders from past failed administrations, positions that were not open to us. And so if you were somebody who made a mess of the peace process over the last 20 years, you can be an expert at Brookings or at whatever, wherever you want to be, and man, the doors are open because we just need to talk to what's going on in the peace process, and we'll talk to the people who blew it 20 years ago. Or a disturbing phenomenon that has developed, I think even more so, is the networks talking to themselves. And it has become, I think it's to the detriment of all of us that reporters talk to reporters, whether it's Fox or whether it's MSNBC or whether it's CNN. Whatever the issue is, it's reporters talking to reporters. Tell me what you're reporting right now, and tell me what you think about what you're reporting right now. And damage is done because they're basically talking to themselves, reinforcing whatever bias or prejudice they already have. CNN's different because CNN has reduced it, I think, even lower down the scale, and that is we have somebody from the right and somebody from the left, and they just let them hammer it out as if there is no truth, there is no reality. What there is are two equal views, and we're going to let them make fools of themselves arguing with each other. It's done a great disservice to the political discourse. Now, I had my own run-ins with these folks. I used to do the Tony Snow show in the morning when that poor guy who passed away way too early was on. We had a respectful conversation for about 7 to 10 minutes in his Saturday morning show. It was great. Tony Snow died, and I very rarely would get calls. Some of the calls I would get are like this. And I might say for in my own personal situation, I probably earned the right to not get called by the bookers because I was not nice. They would call me and they'd say, we want you to come on. Fox called and say, we want you to come on today and we're talking about Afghanistan. And I'd say, I don't know anything about Afghanistan. And they say, oh, it doesn't matter. We've got somebody from the right and we need somebody from the left. And I say, I'm sorry, I don't talk about something I don't know about. And the booker, she actually laughed. She said, nobody ever says that to us. I said, well, you know, call it the Zogby rule. I just don't want to do this. This is not, she said, but we'll get you the daily talking points. We're not talking with the daily wire stories, the stuff off the wall. I said, this doesn't matter. I'm not reading the newspaper and coming on and talking to you about it. I need to know something about it. And then one time I did Bill O'Reilly, and that was the last time I was on Fox because it was about Arafat. And he started to talk. Actually, there's a book that somebody wrote. This actually made it into the book. He asked me a question, and I said, I started to answer, and he interrupted. And I started again, and he interrupted. And finally, I said, Bill, I tell you what, where I come from, you were the host. You invited me. I'm the guest. That means that you actually owe me something, being polite. And if you listened, you might learn something, and your people out there watching might learn something, but if we're just going to do this all night, Nobody's going to pick up anything on this. Well, he shut up, and he didn't say another word, but I never got called back again. CNN was different. CNN does the left-right thing, and so they want me to be on with Bill Bennett to talk about Iraq. And I said, what the hell's Bill Bennett know about Iraq? I mean, if you want to talk about, you know, drug policy, fine. Or you want to talk about gambling and losing a lot of money in Las Vegas, fine. But he doesn't do Iraq. But you're from the left and he's from the right. And that's the way they wanted to play it. And a good show was when you actually beat each other enough, beat each other up enough that they actually found it entertaining. And I don't want to go home every time I do a TV show and have to take a bath. And so what? I don't know if others reacted the same way, but frankly, that's what happened to me personally. But I found increasingly that the networks, like I said, have their own panels. And so you have, you know, this illustrious group of CNN people who are there to talk about whether it's impeachment or whether it's North Korea or whether it's Wall Street or whether it's whatever. Doesn't matter what the issue is. They're going to talk about it. And frankly, aren't experts. They are paid hacks, good word. Not mine, yours. No, but I mean, that's actually the problem. And so we have largely become, I mean, there are some remarkable voices in our community, but look at after everything that happened in Gaza. Yousef Munayyer was on, I think, one show, and Nora Erekat, I think, was on the network, CBS, the online version. The absence of them from the major shows was really quite striking. We had to work real hard. Andrea Mitchell is a friend, and so I got to do her show, and I think I did something else. Oh, Chris Hayes, yeah, he called unsolicited. But that's really a problem across the board. And so I don't know. What I do know is, though, that there are plenty of other venues that are available to us today to actually make news. And I see groups like I said, Jewish Voice for Peace and others actually making news right now. And we'll have plenty of opportunities between now and 2020 to do that. And so we just have to be more creative in how we create stories. Right here, you want to do it, and then here?
Just before, we have an online question, and the question is, what do you expect to be the future of Israel and the U.S. relationship as we start to see a shift in media being a little more critical of Israel?
I think that there are shifts occurring in public opinion. Like I said, it's a partisan gap that has opened and become deeper. I don't necessarily see a shift in policy yet. That will require a political change. And the political change only occurs in the context of elections. Our politicians have to know that there's a painful price to pay. I don't think we're there yet, but I think that the day is coming when, you know, when we'll see people responding to this issue because their pollsters or their consultants are telling them, you really don't want to go down this road right now because your electorate is just not there. It's going to take a little more, but I think that that's the direction you move in. Nothing will change in the relationship because even now, in the wake of everything that happened in Gaza, you have AIPAC working hard in Congress to get some pretty disgusting legislation out that basically wants to give Israel the store, maybe more access to U.S. weaponry than the U.S. military does. You have anti-BDS bills being dropped, one this week, I think it is. It's going to take more. Those guys who are doing this have to know and have to be made to feel when they go home that there's a political price to pay. I don't think we're there yet. Yeah. Here, and then here.
Hi, I know there are certainly no simple solutions here, but I'm wondering about, are there any, what kind of parallels there might be with the African-American situation in the United States with the Kurds in the Middle East, with the Catholic and the Protestant Irish. Is there something that you can learn from them, or you, or they can learn from the Palestinian movement?
I think that there's obviously experiences in many quarters that are there for lessons to be learned. And there are profound differences too, obviously. I mean, the Irish experience in some ways is the same, but in other ways is very different, in part because you had a British government and an American government that were determined to come to a resolution. You don't have that here. You also had a flexibility, at least on the Catholic side in Ireland. I think the Protestant side needed some kicking and screaming and some assurances that they would be protected as part of the United Kingdom. But I also think that the South Africa experience, I think, has some parallels too. The difference there was that you had an African American community here that was far more substantial in its political clout and in its ability to move opinion. I mean, when black leadership here adopted South Africa and began together with white allies to do their strike, their sit downs in front of the embassy, we don't have the capacity I tried to organize a bit of the same thing over the embassy move, and really couldn't find a whole lot of interest. People want to do a vigil at the White House or a press conference here, but. And I think to some extent, right. I mean, when you've got a community that is such a substantial part of the Democratic Party, African Americans, organizing a sit-in and drawing a line saying this issue is absolutely central to us, that's fundamentally different than a community that is still struggling for acceptance here in the States, doing it without a whole lot of allies surrounding it. What's interesting, I think, is the extent to which these communities are now moving in the direction of understanding the Palestinian issue. And so it's not so much lessons learned from their experiences in other struggles as much as it is them feeling an affinity with what Palestinians are enduring. And we just honored this year at Gibran an Irish Senator, Frances Black. We honored her for a project she runs called the Rise Foundation, dealing with victims of what she calls the silent victims of alcohol and drug abuse, that is family members who usually are ignored in treatment. You treat the addict, but the kids and the wife or the husband who've been victimized by this situation usually just are ignored. And so we honored her for that, but she also is chair of the Palestine Working Group in the Irish Senate and just came back from Gaza and has been just gave an incredible, if you look on either my Twitter account, which is JJZ1600, or AIUSA, which is the Institute's Twitter account, you'll see a posting of Frances Black's speech in the Irish Senate, in which she's supporting legislation that would in fact call for Palestinian statehood and call for Israel to boycott products coming from the West Bank from settlements. Very passionate speech by an incredible leader. And I think, you know, that's having an impact on Irish Americans who see this great woman who they know as a singer. She's a very famous singer from the Black family in Ireland. Same with what's happening with young people and young American Jews in particular who are just doing extraordinary stuff. I mean, the If Not Now demonstrations in front of the Trump Hotel were really important. And so they create, there is a kind of a new space open for debate and discourse on this that I think is quite significant. And that will feed on itself, and I think it's going to grow. Yeah? You have the mic. Who's the mic? Yes. Here? and then here. No, back then, back there, and then you. Sorry.
This to go back to the French and English British imperialism, and the Balfour period early on. By the way, your speech was most interesting. Thank you very much. At that time, there was the, and I don't think you mentioned it, the presence of Germany as a rising power, and very aggressive, and there were two world wars that we fought, and we got the money. From Balfour went to the Zionist movement, to the Jews, and got the money for the arms. And that is why I think what I've read way, way back was the reason that the British were very grateful to the Zionists because they could get the money to buy the arms to fight the war. Now, I may be wrong, but I've read it.
I actually don't know. I mean, I know that people... I know that people have made the argument, Brits have made the argument that that the British government wanted the support of the Jewish community internationally. It's never really put in those terms, but they wanted that support. The language that I have in the book and the stuff that I've known and have documented is the strategic value that they saw in Palestine of having a group who could colonize on their behalf this territory to protect it as a strategic asset. That was the part that I know and have documentation to show here and then here. And I understand the point, but the issue here is that, and I'm not going to get in an argument with you, but we're dealing with reality is never pretty. It's oftentimes unfortunate. What we must acknowledge, and there are. By count, 3 or 4 generations of people living in what is today Israel, they're not going anywhere. And it was tough for the Irish in the Republic to acknowledge that they've lived with this unified Ireland. It may come about. I actually think Brexit may hasten the unification of the island because economic interest may end up dominating over the national identity. I mean, putting a hard border is going to be awful tough. You go to Ireland today, you crisscross up and down, your GPS directs you through, you know, the shortest way from Donegal to Dublin is to go straight through a place that you could not have traveled before the Good Friday Agreement. And so do they want to go back to that? I don't think so. I think that, you know, we're going to see an evolution of this issue as we go forward, but we're not there yet. And I think that reality dictates that we understand that there are about 6 million people who call themselves Israelis and who live in what is today Israel. And how that works its way forward as we go into the future, Lord only knows. I mean, I used to debate this issue back in the 70s, and they'd say, do you believe in the right of Israel to exist for all eternity? And I'd say, I don't know. I guess that the Romans asked people that question too, you know? And I mean, I'm an American, and I actually love the opportunities that this country has given to me, the son of an illegal immigrant, to do what I do today. But frankly, America's not going to live for all eternity, and that gets people like in a tizzy, you know. And then they can go, they could pummel you alive and you know eat your flesh over saying that. But the reality is that history is history. I don't know how it works out in the end. I mean, we elected a black president, for God's sake. Some white people are never going to forgive themselves for that or forgive the country for that, and they're still sort of this is payback time with this guy. We don't know where it ends up or how it plays out. What I do know is that the struggle for justice, the struggle for human rights, the struggle for peace is what counts. And the form that it takes in the end, I don't know. I don't know where we go. What I'd like to see, what would I like to see? I'd like to see the land that Martin Buber wanted, the land that your relatives wanted, which is where, you know, people welcome each other and host each other and treat each other as equals and support each other when they're in need. That's what I would like to see. How do we get there? Well, first, we got to stop killing each other. And the way to stop that is to create justice, at least the modicum of justice that allows people to survive. And I think there are red lines to what is justice and what is not justice. From everything I've seen of the Trump plan, it is not justice. It doesn't make sense to offer somebody, I mean, it's like inviting a vegan to your house and putting a roast beef in front of them. It's like you know that they're not going to accept it. So it's a cruel, cynical ploy to say, here's the offer. A lot of tough work. I don't think America's ready for it. I don't think America will ever be ready for it. I think it's got to be internationalized, but we're not ready to surrender the reins on it yet. Too many people have died. Many more people are going to die. It's horrible. But the reality is we've got to acknowledge that today there are two peoples there that have got to figure out, we've got to figure out a solution that at least stops the shedding and begins to move us in a direction where we can accommodate and find a way forward. Do I think, look, I said one time, and I was speaking at a synagogue here, and they asked me what I saw the future. And I said, I look 100 years down the road, and I think that an Arab boy from Amman is going to marry a Jewish girl from Tel Aviv, and they're going to live in the suburbs of Damascus. It may sound crazy today. Actually, given when I said it, there wasn't, Damascus was a very, but the reality is, you know, who would have thought you got a Polish plumbers in London? Now, a lot of Brits aren't ready to accept that yet, and so they want to play that game too. But we're moving in, history moves in that direction. A lot of bounces, a lot of ups and downs, a lot of weird curves in the road. But at the end of the day, that's where we're moving. The question is, how do we not put up more obstacles to get there?
You've been listening to James Zugby, founder and president of the Arab American Institute in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBZ.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.